This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 12, 2003. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. President Bush was plotting the war against Iraq just days after he took power in January 2001, according to a former Bush cabinet member, Paul O'Neill. Reports this weekend indicate that the US may be planning to set up an office in Libya for the first time in over 20 years. And protests hot up against the auto show in Los Angeles, saying Americans are addicted to oil. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Monica Lopez with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. government is getting serious about their plans to obtain and store vast amounts of personal information on all air travelers, even U.S. citizens and others with valid residency papers. Rihanna Ortiz reports from D.C.
The Transportation Security Administration is implementing a plan to force airlines to hand over all passenger information in an attempt to spot potential terrorists. Depending on personal information and itinerary, passengers will be scored with a number and a color that ranks their threat level. A second program would allow frequent flyers to gain quicker access through security checkpoints in exchange for volunteering detailed personal information, so far unspecified. Civil rights groups claim that these measures are discriminatory and rely on data such as race and financial class to target suspected terrorists. Mark Rottenberg, the executive director of the Electronic Information Center in Washington, D.C., is also concerned about potential ulterior uses.
If they can't stop terrorists, they say, well, maybe we can find wanted people or maybe we can find missing children. Invariably, these systems are used in new ways.
Airlines are also opposing these measures. They did not cooperate during the testing phase of the program, forcing the government to make compliance mandatory. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rihanna Ortiz.
President Bush will be in Monterrey, Mexico today, supposedly to discuss with his Latin American counterparts how to benefit the poor and develop democracy. However, Bush has scheduled closed-door bilateral meetings with some of the hemisphere's more friendly, although still left-leaning leaders in Chile and Brazil. At this time, there is no scheduled meeting with the populist president, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. Chavez is also leading the growing consensus among developing nations to fight U.S. economic dominance and create trade partnerships with terms more favorable to home-based groups rather than U.S. or European-based multinationals. Analysts say this is also a chance for Bush to mend fences with President Vicente Fox of Mexico, whom the U.S. president distanced after the invasion of Iraq. Guatemala's highest court ordered the government to stop payment to former civil patrollers who some say are responsible for human rights atrocities. Catherine Elton reports from Guatemala City.
Guatemala's constitutional court ruled Thursday that the compensation payment to the civil patrollers violates the Constitution. Outgoing President Alfonso Portillo ordered the compensation in a move widely considered to have been an attempt to win votes for his party's presidential candidate, former dictator Efraín Ríos Montt. Massacre survivors and rights activists were outraged by the payment and filed the demand before the courts. Guatemala's version of the Truth Commission found that civil patrollers were involved in human rights violations during the war. The incoming security commissioner for President-elect Oscar Berger said that when he takes office on January 15th, he will investigate whether it is possible to change the wording of the compensation law to render it constitutional and reinstate the payments. For FSRN News, I'm Catherine Elton in Guatemala City.
New requirements for the New York State death penalty will be debated this week. From WBAI in New York, Ian Forrest reports.
When attorneys from the Capitol Defender's Office take their case to the New York Court of Appeals this Wednesday, they will be objecting to calls by lawyers for convicted murderer Angel Mateo to make their jobs harder. Mateo's lawyers argue that no person should get the death penalty unless there's evidence beyond doubt. They want to raise the bar from the current standard of reasonable doubt. The move is just the latest, among others, to reform the death penalty statute all around the country. Legal luminaries have lined up on either side of the debate, and there's a clear split in opinion. Many pro-death penalty advocates argue that the higher standards would assure the public that when the death penalty is given, it is justified. Reform advocates say that if approved, the death penalty would ensure that only the worst of the worst get the death penalty. Reporting for FSRN, I am Ian Forrest.
A University of Idaho student from Saudi Arabia faces new charges of terrorism over insistences he is innocent. Lee Robartis reports from Idaho.
Upon his arrest for visa fraud last February, federal prosecutors implied computer security major Sami Al-Hussein was helping funnel money to terrorist groups. The grand jury indictment on Friday accuses the 34-year-old of knowing his computer services would be used to recruit and raise funds for violent jihad, particularly in Palestine and Chechnya. The indictment says Al-Hussein built and managed websites for the Islamic Assembly of North America, the Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation, Dar al-Asr, and two Saudi sheikhs, all being investigated by U.S. authorities for ties to terrorism. One of his attorneys, David Nevin, said even if the allegations are assumed to be true, they're talking about free speech. Nevin believes the government delayed pursuing terrorism charges until now so they could put off next week's scheduled visa fraud trial set for Boise. Lee Robartis, Free Speech Radio News.
From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Monica Lopez.
Syria's President Bashar Assad today turned down an invitation from Israel to visit the country and begin peace negotiations. This diplomacy takes place as Israeli construction crews hoisted 25 feet high concrete slabs into the middle of a main road in a Palestinian suburb of Jerusalem today, cutting off thousands of people from the city they consider their home. The impenetrable wall is part of a series of barriers Israel is building around much of the West Bank, they say, to keep out Palestinian suicide bombers. Palestinians call it an apartheid wall. The concrete wall has cut Palestinians off from their fields, schools, hospitals, and businesses. Meanwhile, some 20,000 Jewish settlers and their supporters took to the streets protesting against Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his plans to relinquish some Jewish settlements in a possible peace settlement with Palestinians. Iris Makler reports from Jerusalem.
Protests against Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in the centre of Tel Aviv, this time from the right wing, his own heartland. The huge crowd included cabinet ministers from his right-wing coalition government, as well as ministers and politicians from his own Likud party. The Speaker of Israel's parliament, the Knesset, also attended, although he said he was there in a personal capacity. Leader of the National Religious Party, Effie Etam, summarised the reason the crowd was there. Anger with the Prime Minister over his plans to trade land for peace, or to make a unilateral withdrawal from sections of the West Bank and Gaza if no settlement can be reached with the Palestinians. Ariel Sharon, just now when you have won a historic victory over the forces of terror, you're becoming weak, said Effie Etam, threatening to resign from the coalition government if Israel withdraws from any land it controls. In Jerusalem, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said he would not give in to demonstrators.
There is a government in Israel, and things are decided not by demonstrators, but by the government. The government adopted the roadmap.
But his plans for unilateral withdrawal have also drawn fire from the Palestinian leadership. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kouraya threatening that a unilateral withdrawal would not achieve the security Israel was seeking. He also called on Israel to stop building new Jewish settlements, as well as the wall in the West Bank. He said that the Palestinian Authority is now investigating its own unilateral declaration of a state, with Jerusalem as the Palestinian capital. Ariel Sharon addressed the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, Monday, asking for endorsement of his plans. It was a noisy session where he didn't specify any detail of his proposals, certainly not going as far as he had outside the parliament last month at a speech in Herzliya. This way he may have headed off the threat to his coalition government. But it's not clear if after 3 years in office he will take any action on the most urgent issue facing Israel, resolving the conflict with the Palestinians. Israeli analysts suggest that Prime Minister Sharon is showing his skill as a politician, but not as a statesman. All this takes place against the backdrop of a diplomatic dance with Syria. Israel and Syria have never signed a peace deal, and one of the issues over which they have been in conflict for more than three decades is the Golan Heights. Israel captured the Golan from Syria in the 1967 war and annexed it in 1981. 17,000 Jews now live there, but the annexation is not recognized by Syria, which demands the return of the strategically significant area. Last month, President Bashar Assad put out feelers to renew peace negotiations, first via an interview in the New York Times and then via an intermediary, Turkey. Prime Minister Sharon was hesitant, but today Israel's president, Moshe Katsav, stepped in and invited the Syrian president to Israel. I invite the president of Syria to come to Jerusalem to meet with the country's leaders and conduct serious negotiations, if that's his wish, says President Katsav. I'm the president of Israel and I have the authority to invite foreign presidents to come here, he said. However, it seems that the Israeli president has called Syria's bluff. Within hours of the offer, a Syrian spokeswoman had turned the invitation down, telling the BBC Arabic service that President Assad did not take this offer seriously and that he was only interested in serious offers. So on all fronts in the conflict here, on the northern border and with the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, the stalemate continues. Iris Makler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
Reports this weekend indicate that the US may be planning to set up an office in Libya for the first time in over 20 years. As first reported by the Washington Post, the office would be a diplomatic mission, but US officials later disputed the description, according to the Agence France-Presse. The two countries do not have diplomatic relations. The news outlets said the office would provide logistical, technical, and secretarial support for US and British arms inspectors overseeing the dismantling of Libya's unconventional weapons program. Washington and London announced last month that the North African state had vowed to abandon its efforts to develop weapons of mass destruction after 9 months of secret negotiations. UN sanctions against Libya were lifted in September after the Libyan leader signed a compensation deal for the 1988 Lockerbie bombing over Scotland, but President Bush last week said US sanctions would remain in place until Libya's intentions are verified. Susan Wood has more from the United Nations.
When Libya agreed last month to dismantle its unconventional weapons programs and open its facilities to international inspections, some commentators saw it as vindication of the Bush administration's get-tough policy with would-be proliferators, especially the war against Saddam Hussein. Ali Abdulatif Amidah was born in Libya and is chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He sees Libya's move as part of a long-term shift culminating in its handover of the two suspects wanted in the 1988 Lockerbie bombing.
Many changes were happening in Libyan foreign policy toward Egypt, toward Tunisia, after the turning the two suspects to the Hague trial. The European community, most of the countries there, have resumed diplomatic relationship with Libya. So I think to say this is just because of Iraq, not completely true.
Alistair Miller, vice president of the Fourth Freedom Forum, says the main factor in making the change was Libya's desire to end its isolation and get out from under crushing economic sanctions. He contrasts the U.S. approach with that of its European allies, citing the example of Iran, which agreed in October to stop processing uranium and open its facilities to more intrusive UN inspections.
The efforts of the French and the British in particular, and the Germans, in going over to Tehran to talk about these issues with the government that had been isolated and rejected by the US, shows that the alternative approach to that used in Iraq is viable and is a way to exact what we would like to see from problem countries, if you will, without spilling blood and causing enormous amounts of damage and rifts within the international community.
While Iran maintains that its nuclear program is strictly for peaceful purposes, Libya has admitted seeking to develop nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, but is years away from having a nuclear bomb, according to the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, which inspected four sites in December. Joseph Gerson is Peace and Security Director for the American Friends Service Committee.
Why did they want to have nuclear weapons? For the same reason that China and Russia, India and Pakistan have wanted nuclear weapons, essentially to develop a deterrent arsenal, one that can deter either the United States or the nation most immediately threatening it, which in the case of Libya has also included Israel.
Gerson notes that the Bush administration has obtained funding from Congress to refurbish the Nevada nuclear test site, and if reelected, is widely expected to resume underground nuclear testing for the first time since 1992.
This will be one of the most forceful actions pressing proliferation globally that one can imagine. It will take all the shackles off of other nations in terms of testing their existing nuclear arsenals or other nations attempting to develop deterrent forces for this.
Gerson notes that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which prohibits Iran and Libya from acquiring nuclear weapons, also requires the U.S. to abandon its nuclear arsenal. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
President Bush was plotting the war against Iraq just days after he took power in January 2001, according to a former Bush cabinet member, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. O'Neill revealed the information to CBS's 60 Minutes. We're joined by senior Pacifica political news analyst Larry Bensky. Larry, is Paul O'Neill just confirming what the anti-war movement has said all along, or is this sour grapes from a fired Bush cabinet member?
I think it's a little of each, but the impact of this is very great because it does come from the inside of an administration that has prided itself on keeping to the line of the day and very disciplined message manipulation. The fact that this confirms what many people have said all along can be very damaging for Bush down the line and will certainly be a part of the ammunition that the eventual Democratic Party candidate uses against him in the campaign this year.
Now, do you think anything will come out of this? As we've talked about, the anti-war movement has been saying this for a while. What levels of accountability could there be from these kind of revelations by Paul O'Neill?
Unfortunately, with the Republicans in control of the legislative and the judicial process in this country through the Attorney General and through Congress, any investigation of the Bush administration will have to come from journalists, and they have not been exactly beating down the walls and doors as far as the corporate press goes. But this is an important breach in the wall of secrecy and the wall of unanimity. And it isn't just about Bush. It's largely about Dick Cheney, who was very close to Secretary O'Neill in their previous political lives and who is revealed through what O'Neill is saying as having been the master manipulator of a George Bush who is seen as what a lot of people have pictured him as, basically a figurehead for the administration who can get pushed around by the most right-wing elements within it.
In England, we see the possibility of parliamentarians being held accountable for misleading Parliament for going to war with Iraq. Could that happen in the United States? Could Congress people be held accountable or hold the Bush administration accountable for misleading Congress?
They could if they were the opposition were in control of the legislative process, but it isn't. And one of the things that the Republicans have been most concerned to do is make sure that the Democrats have no forum in which to conduct congressional hearings and investigations. The Republicans are in charge of setting the agendas. Now, at times in American history, such as in the Nixon administration, for example, you had defecting Republicans, but envisaging such a thing happening in this country right now, you'd need a lot more of the kind of ammunition that Mr. O'Neill has provided before one could see the Republican Party's solidarity cracking significantly.
Larry, the question begs also of Paul O'Neill. Should he be held accountable for being a party to this?
Well, only if there were an effective war crimes tribunal internationally, but of course the United States has seen to it or tried to see to it that that doesn't take place, and so far it would have jurisdiction over United States citizens. I think that holding any of the cabinet members or the members of the Bush administration accountable right now is basically going to be a function of the political process. And once the Democrats have finished cutting each other up and fighting each other off, if someone who sees this as a strong wedge issue emerges as a Democratic presidential nominee, then it definitely could be a subject of further pursuit. But as I say, the system here and the system in Great Britain are very different as far as what Parliament and Congress can and cannot do in going after somebody who may have misled.
Larry Bensky, senior Pacifica news analyst. Thanks for joining us on Free Speech Radio News. Over the course of 10 days, over 1 million people attended the annual Los Angeles Auto Show held in the downtown convention center. On Thursday, Rainforest Action Network and Global Exchange unfurled a large banner outside a 32-story building near the convention to highlight Americans' addiction to oil, leading to the arrest of five activists. This past weekend, hundreds of demonstrators turned out to protest the show. From KPFK in Los Angeles, Aura Bogado files this report.
Protesters called on car companies and local, state, and federal government to double the average fuel economy of all car fleets to 50 miles per gallon by 2010, to double the number of buses in LA to 5,000, and in the process to cut in half the number of cars on LA streets. Silvio Juarez of the Bus Riders Union explains the risks that everyday Angelenos are exposed to because of the overwhelming amount of pollution emitted by inefficient vehicles.
We feel that these gas guzzlers like SUVs and Hummers and a few other vehicles that really don't serve the purpose that you would think they would be serving are merely contaminating, and our lungs are in danger. And not only that, but the traffic conditions in Los Angeles especially are getting so disgustingly ridiculous that we definitely need more buses, and buses that have clean fuel engines like natural gas would be the key. So that's why we're here, and we're letting people know they're here at the auto show. Why? They're going to buy another gas guzzler? You know, luxury that is totally ridiculous.
The Labor Strategy Center initiated their long-term campaign to reduce the causes of global warming by improving public transportation years ago, making LA County their primary focus with an aim to gain national and international attention. At the rally, they handed out bummers to car companies, awards that highlighted the car industry's practices. Ford, whose typical vehicle today gets worse mileage than their Model T did over 80 years ago, received the bummer for worse overall fuel efficiency. Big cars like SUVs and pickup trucks produce double the amount of greenhouse gases than do their compact counterparts and contribute to a massive epidemic of cancers for children. It didn't take long for people who attended the rally to make the connection between the local auto show and the effects of the vehicle industry on the world at large, such as making children sick and dragging nations into wars for oil. Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange says that building coalitions is crucial in this time of crisis.
It's a great example of how we have to come together with people who are demanding better public transportation as well as more fuel-efficient cars, because the cars and trucks we drive are using up 40% of the oil use in this country. The only way that we're going to cut that down dramatically is if we provide better public transportation for people so they don't need to drive around in cars. And for those who continue to need cars, they have alternatives like the Prius and many more alternatives that we need to have fuel-efficient cars.
Hybrid and electric cars paraded in circles around the convention, as did a spontaneous group of about 50 bike riders who rode their bikes in impeded traffic to bring attention to the fact that it takes no fuel, hybrid, electric, or otherwise, to get around. Philip Franco, who participated in the action, says that people need to remember to consider using this form of transportation more often, and that ultimately, everyday people are the ones who need to take an increased responsibility.
I think the action in itself, by us riding and transporting ourselves without the use of gasoline and using Chevron's and Exxon's fuels, is a statement in itself that we know that global warming is a factor, and it's up to us to stop it. No, it's not the industry. They're not going to do it. They're totally opposed to what our actions are now, and they've become aggressive on cyclists and pedestrians, and just our actions in riding our bikes simply is what our statement is.
Federal law continues to allow SUVs to consume 30% more gas than passenger cars, and it's estimated that since 1990, they've guzzled up 70 billion gallons of gasoline. Pollutants ranging from carbon monoxide to particulate matter continue to wreak havoc on the health of citizens throughout the world. By raising public consciousness on these issues, community activists hope to elicit enough pressure to change policy to improve public transportation and increase fuel efficiency. Reporting from KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
3 years after the first World Social Forum, or WSF, in Brazil's Porto Alegre, this week in the Indian city of Mumbai, tens of thousands of participants will attend over 1,000 seminars and conferences, testimonies and cultural events as part of the first social forum in Asia. Meanwhile, as Bombay prepares for the forum, the people of Ellore, a small island in Kerala, the most literate state of India, is hoping the international attention on India will spotlight their island, which residents liken to living in a gas chamber. International environmental groups have named Ellore one of the world's most toxic spots. Environmentalists charge that the companies have bought off the people by giving employment to at least one member of each family in Ellore. The people of Ellore say they're in a catch-22 situation. Inhale the poison, or protest and die of starvation. Our correspondent, Binu Alex, visited Ellore. He files this report.
TV George is an Elu resident. More than 5 years of inhaling poison has made him almost brain dead and unable to even breathe.
Inhaling poison for decades. I can't even breathe now. Leave alone, conversing. Just surviving under medication.
Located in the South Indian state of Kerala, Ellur has a population of around 30,000. It's a major industrial town where more than 300 factories pump pollutants into the air and rivers around this island. Like TV George, almost everyone in Ellu is dying a premature death. Greenpeace recently released the findings of a study on Ellur's water and sediments. It reveals that the toxins released by the factories contain 100 organic compounds, including GDT and its metabolites and indosulfan. Residents of Ellur are contracting cancer at a rate 3 times higher than similar toxic areas in India. And amidst these dangers come one question, the question of corporate accountability. Satyanath Sarangi, who is fighting the case for Bhopal victims for the same issue, believes this is never addressed by the corporate bodies.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very, very serious issue, and there's an issue of, if you just consider the number of victims it has made, it's one of the fundamental issues today, is how to ensure corporate accountability. Because today, as you see, there's such a big difference in individual crime and corporate crime.
The company Hindustan Insecticides is one of Ellur's major polluters. Pesticides and chemicals form a major part of the production in Ellur. According to Vijay Jose, a Greenpeace activist, gas leaks occur regularly.
Last month there was a chlorine gas leak followed by a sulfuric acid leak that flowed to the river.
Passengers of the frequent ferry services cover their noses as they arrive from the other end of the Periyar River to Ellur. The dumping of toxic waste into the rivers has destroyed the marine life and has negatively impacted the fishing community. Still, closing the factories would create a huge unemployment vacuum. Again, Greenpeace Riverkeeper Vijay Jose.
We're not asking to close these factories. On the contrary, more industries should come and usher in development. But that should not be at the cost of the environment and the lives of the poor. The big factories here have non-functional effluent plants. To increase the profits by cutting costs, they ignore this. The smaller factories have no such plant. How these people got permission from the Pollution Control Board is a big mystery.
However, for many residents, the possibility of selling one's land is not an option. Real estate investors avoid this region because of water and air contamination. Meanwhile, the local government continues to ignore environmental grievances, saying the factories are important in a state with such a high unemployment rate. A recent UN study has equated health and civil society of Kerala, where Ellur is located, with that of developed countries like the US. But victims like Sundaran Ayyappan, a daily wage laborer, have no answers to this kind of haphazard industrial development.
Almost everyone at home has one or the other disease. My children cannot breathe properly. Since my childhood, I see government officials checking the water pollution, but without any action. We have a short lifespan because of this, a maximum of 50 years, not more.
Although the Indian government signed the Stockholm Treaty on phasing out persistent organic pollutants, there have been no results indicating a proper cleanup. The issue of highly skilled unemployment has allowed the factories to ignore the complaints of the community. And workers say they must keep working or lose their jobs and their livelihoods. From Cochin in South Indian state of Kerala, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can go to our website for an archive of the newscast, www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.